Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Double Purpose podcast episode. By double purpose, what I mean is that I'm featuring this interview on both of my podcasts, my Overcoming Chronic Illness podcast, as well as my Optimistic Future podcast. For those of you that don't know, I have two podcasts. The Overcoming Chronic Illness podcast features interviews with doctors, clinicians, and other experts that have things of relevance to say for folks who are dealing with complex chronic illnesses, conditions like fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, chronic infections, long COVID, mold toxicity, things like that. And then my Optimistic Future podcast involves or on that podcast, I interview folks who have information to share that relates to some of the challenges that our world is facing. There are lots of wonderful, beautiful, lovely things in this world, lots of good things in this world, but of course, there are also lots of challenges as well, economic challenges, social challenges, environmental challenges, and others. And for us as individuals, myself included, when you think about all the things going on in the world that needs to be worked on, it can be kind of overwhelming and can kind of be in a sense paralyzed into inaction. Just a lot of us don't have the time or resources to start up a nonprofit organization. We can't spend dozens of hours every week volunteering for different groups and whatnot trying to work on these issues. However, it's my steadfast belief that there are simple steps that we can all take in our day-to-day lives to work to address those challenges collectively. So whether it's something like waiting until, if you live in a northern hemisphere, waiting until June before you start mowing your lawn and doing yard work, because that helps to salvage habitats for pollinators, so it helps to reduce the declining pollinator issue in this world, or something like trying to buy as many groceries as you can from farmers markets, because that contributes to better food security, helps to reduce food waste, helps to support our middle class and kind of bolster the economy of the local community. So these are just a couple of examples, and cherry picking from past episodes, things that we can kind of small steps that we can all do in our day-to-day lives to collectively make a big difference. So those are the two podcasts. So I'm going to explain who my guest is today, and then I'll explain how the interview with her relates to both of those podcasts. So my guest today is named Lara Adler. Lara is on Instagram. Her handle is the Environmental Toxins Nerd. I say this very affectionately. She is indeed a big environmental toxins nerd. She, drills into the biochemistry, the literature around environmental toxins, and that would include things like pesticides, herbicides, volatile organic compounds, glyphosate, which would be the active component of Roundup. Like, these are just some of the ones that you've probably heard of, these different toxins or chemicals that we're exposed to. And she basically talks about how they can have significant impacts on our health and a variety of other things. So we'll get into all of that in the interview. So why is it that this relates to the complex chronic illness or slash the Overcoming Chronic Illness podcast? Well, folks who are, quite frankly, these chemicals are not good for any of us, whether we're generally healthy or generally not healthy at all. But for those of us who are, for folks out there who are dealing with complex chronic illnesses, the importance of avoiding those chemicals, in my opinion, is that much more paramount. When we're exposed to these chemicals, they have a number of negative health impacts, not the least of which include, depleting our antioxidant levels. They damage our cell membranes. They interfere with our mitochondrial function. Some of them are literal mitochondrial poisons. And anyone who's listened to my Overcoming Chronic Illness podcast knows how important mitochondrial function is for general health, longevity, health span, but also for recovery from these complex chronic illnesses. So I'm hoping that after the chat with Lara today, we'll have a better sense of how one can avoid exposure to those chemicals, likely by making some fairly simple switcheroos with personal care products, maybe avoiding things like perfumes and colognes, other artificially scented products, things like that. So we'll see what Lara has to say. So that's the relevance of the Overcoming Chronic Illness podcast. The relevance to the Optimistic Future podcast is, as mentioned, we do face a lot of environmental challenges. A lot of these chemicals are really not good for the ecosystem. They're bad for the plants, bad for the animals, bad for our waterways. So that alone, I think, is a good enough reason why we should really be aware of where these chemicals are coming from and what the alternatives are to those. Whether it's something as simple as, just start buying natural cleaners, for example. Don't use perfume. Don't use cologne. Don't use, artificially scented room fresheners and whatnot. If you need something that has an art, lovely scent, things that are scented with essential oils, to my understanding, are a much healthier option. So again, we'll talk about simple steps that one could make a switch with. So, within the interview coming up in just a moment. Over and above the environmental impact of these chemicals, there is also the aforementioned health impact as well. And even if folks listening aren't, you know, dealing with complex chronic illness, hopefully many of you listening are not dealing with that. These chemicals have notable negative impacts on other elements of our health. There are links between a number of different chemicals with, you know, cancer development, cardiovascular impact. Some of these chemicals are associated with causing chronic headaches and migraines and things like that. And there are also potential negative health impacts on our children as well. So from a health perspective, from an environmental health perspective, I think that being aware of this topic is really important. And if after hearing this interview, if you're thinking like, nope, I really like my Axe body spray, I really like my Febreze, and you know, it's too important to me to have those in my life, you know, that's okay. There are other things that you can do to make a positive impact on the world. But I'm hoping that the chat that I have today with Lara will inspire folks to just really think about like, oh, what is in these products that I'm working with or that I'm using in my day-to-day life or, you know, personal care products or whatnot? And are there some simple switches that can be made to have a healthier impact on the environment and on ourselves? So I will leave it there for now as far as the intro. Just before I bring Lara into the chat here, I do just want to mention, since we will be talking about some things that have some, you know, relation to health, I will just quickly mention that nothing that her or I are saying during this interview should be construed as medical advice. This is all for informational purposes only. If you need medical advice, please talk to your healthcare provider to get that advice. So with that out of the way, I will pause the recording for just a moment and I will be joined by Lara in just a moment. All right, everyone. So I'm now joined by Lara Adler. Lara, thanks so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks, Brian, for having me.
Well, it's been really looking forward to this chat. I've been following you on Instagram for a long time, but for folks who haven't come across your work on Instagram or elsewhere, would you mind just giving listeners a little background about who you are and how you got involved in the environmental toxins world?
Yeah, my name is Lara Adler. I primarily educate health professionals on the health risks associated with exposure to environmental chemicals. It is a little bit of it's a pretty niche topic. And I like to tell people that I sort of stumbled into this work kind of on accident. I was always somebody that was personally interested in health and nutrition, like a nerdy kid in high school who's interested in like agriculture and farming and like vegetables and like just I was that type of nerd, but I didn't pursue anything professionally in that space. It was just what I did in my personal life. I was the person that was, you know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, was doing like mushroom growing classes and fermentation workshops and going to the farmer's market and visiting farms, and it was like my whole life. Anyway, so I wanted to pursue something in the health space because of this interest. And I turned to health coaching. And so was doing that for a number of years. And it was really through doing that work that I stumbled into the environmental health space on accident, because I had a handful of clients that were coming to me for weight loss. And no matter what they did, nothing really changed for them. And they were frustrated and I was frustrated. And so I started digging into the literature on resistant weight loss to see like, what am I missing? Because I'm clearly missing something. And that was probably 15, 16 years ago, more than that now, probably about 17 years ago, that I was digging into that resistant weight loss. And that's where I stumbled into this idea of, for example, obesogenic chemicals were chemicals that can interfere with metabolism in ways that can either lead to weight gain or resistant weight loss or predispose us to weight gain, even given the same sort of caloric intake that we would normally have. And that completely blew my mind. It was a record scratch. Like, what? I'm sorry, what? Because at that time, nobody was talking about toxicity. Nobody was talking really about chemicals and consumer products. It was not a dialogue that was happening. And so I started digging into the literature on that topic and spent a couple of years researching and reading and, you know, learning from some of the top experts in the field of epidemiology and endocrinology and epigenetics as it relates to environmental chemicals. And I just decided I got to fill this gap in the practitioner space, because nobody that I knew in my health coaching, nutritionist, nurse, circles knew anything about this topic. So that's kind of how I meandered through to land here. And I've been doing this now since 2012, so over a decade.
I'm glad that you are doing what you're doing because, yeah, it's such an important thing to know about and certainly to educate. You know, if we're not, it's good to educate the public, but yeah, educating healthcare providers because they, of course, have such a big impact on, you know, the public. I'm just curious if you wouldn't mind rhyming off like, you know, at least a couple of like obesogenic chemicals because I'm sure folks listening, some folks would be like, oh, I'd like to know about that because I know I certainly
Sure.
have patients who have a hard time, you know, with weight management despite, you know, exercising all the right diet stuff. And we have other things we look into, but what are some of those obesogenic chemicals, if you don't
Yeah,
mind?
unfortunately, they're some of the most common ones that we're exposed to. So bisphenols, BPA specifically, although there's more research into the BPA alternatives like BPS and BPF. BPA has multiple mechanisms of action that can lead to ultimately to weight gain. Phthalates are another one. They're a very common chemical that are found in fragrances and plastics. BPA is found in countless places. Certain PFAS chemicals, which a lot of people are becoming more and more aware of now because they're just in the news constantly because they're being found in so many different places. These are chemicals that are directly linked to changes in metabolism or changes in brain function or change in the way cells are, divide and produce. That can lead to weight gain and other metabolic issues, type 2 diabetes, insulin resistance, cardiovascular disease. And unfortunately, that cluster is really just one endpoint because those same chemicals are also linked to, either genital birth defects or fertility issues or cancers. So there's so many different mechanisms that a single chemical can employ to result in a health effect. And we don't really know how any individual is going to react to exposure to these compounds. It's like a choose your own adventure, unfortunately. It's not a good adventure either.
Not a good one. No, choose your own
No.
misadventure. Maybe I'm not sure. But as far as the obesogenic effect, and I know we're not gonna get into the weeds of the biochemistry, but I just have to ask because I'm a big biochemistry physiology nerd. As far as the obesogenic mechanism of action, like just where you mentioned phthalates and BPA, anyways, like is it through like more of an estrogenic effect, or is it due to mitochondrial disruption, or like could you just speak
Multiple,
briefly?
yeah, so lots of different pathways, unfortunately. It's just, and we're still figuring those out, right? We can still see, we're still teasing apart mechanism of action. We can see an association, but we don't quite know how or why in all instances. But the example that I tend to give the most often, because it's the most interesting, I think, is activation of the PPAR gamma receptor, which is our master sort of conductor or regulator of fat cell development. And what can happen if PPAR gamma gets activated through exposure to, say, bisphenol A, BPA, if a cell is in pre-development, if it's a stem cell, activation of that receptor can actually change the marching orders, if you will, of that stem cell to say, instead of being a bone cell, go be a fat cell. So what that's doing is it's creating a larger quantity of fat cells in the body than would otherwise have been there if PPAR gamma had not been activated by this exposure. The other thing that it does is if PPAR gamma gets activated in the presence of an existing fat cell, it essentially allows for that fat cell to grow larger. So it has a larger capacity for fat retention. And so these two mechanisms are essentially weight gain that happen literally on a cellular level that have absolutely nothing to do with calorie intake or calorie expenditure. And this mechanism of PPAR gamma activation is what we often see with pharmaceuticals that have a well-established side effect of weight gain. There's a lot like antidepressants, there's a lot of medications, antipsychotics that you just look at your doctor will tell you, hey, you might start gaining a little weight on this. That's referred to as chemically induced weight gain. It's well established. And a lot of these environmental chemicals that we're exposed to are capable of doing that same thing. So to me, that's just the most interesting because it's really breaks that kind of mental paradigm of weight gain being about what you're eating and how much you're exercising. And it's just so much more complicated than that.
It's really scary, and it's just really, I'm sure a lot of folks listening are going to be thinking like, oh wow, like this might help to explain what's going on with me, because again, like so many folks, you were seeing this 15 some odd years ago, or sorry, I forget the exact timeline, but I see it in my own practice too, like just people being like, yeah, I'm doing the right things, like exercise, diet, like why is it so hard to lose weight, like why do I have to pull out all the stops, I'm pulling out all the stops and still not losing weight, and like yeah, that's just a really powerful mechanism. So yeah, that's yeah, really, really not good.
Yeah, not great.
I want this kind of segues nicely into one of my next questions here, was just I'd like to talk to you in a moment about what kind of impact environmental toxins can have on folks who are suffering from complex chronic illnesses like fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, et cetera. But I'm just wondering, aside from potentially contributing to, unplanned or unwanted weight gain, what are some impacts of environmental toxins just on kind of people who are generally healthy, will say they don't have, a label of complex chronic illness or some, notable, disease, shall we say, but what are some negatives that could arise from chemical exposure or toxin exposure?
Yeah, I mean, that's both an easy question to answer and a hard one, mostly because the answer is yes, all health issues for the most part, because toxicity, excuse me, toxic chemicals don't, they touch every organ system.
Take
Excuse
your
me.
time. Yep.
Thanks. That's what happens when you record after you eat lunch.
You
It's
can get
it
your
happens
blood.
all I'm just realizing like maybe I should leave a larger gap. Anyway, so the reality is that toxicity touches every environmental chemicals can affect every single organ system in the body and in different ways. And like I was saying earlier, there's no way to say, ah, person A is going to get this exposure and it's going to show up in this manner. We don't know that. And person B might have the same exact exposure and the symptom might manifest differently. And then the other complicating factor is that for most environmental exposures, there's an incredible latency between exposure and effect. So it might take 20, 30 years before a health condition arises. And it's at that point really difficult to kind of pin the tail on the donkey and say, like, aha, it was that. And then because we have so many of these chemicals that are ubiquitous, meaning they're used in thousands of different places, we're getting exposure from, dozens or hundreds of different sources in a given week. How do we identify whether it was this, for example, endocrine disrupting chemical or that endocrine disrupting chemical, or was it the combination of two of them or all of them? So it's a really complicated answer in that. Pretty much every health effect, because every organ system is impacted. So there can be absolutely hormonal impacts, and those themselves all have downstream consequences. You can have a thyroid disruption that results in hair loss or weight gain, right? And so it's like a tree with many branches, and you can look at, for example, environmental chemicals that can disrupt the integrity of the gut lining, that can cause leaky gut. Well, we know there's many downstream consequences to something like leaky gut, inflammation, food reactivity, autoimmune flares. And then there are some chemicals that can directly lead to those same downstream consequences. So really, it's everything from asthma and allergies to learning disabilities, developmental issues, fertility issues, menopausal issues, all types of cancers, digestive issues, brain fog, any kind of neurodegenerative condition, Alzheimer's and dementia. The list goes on and on. Every autoimmune condition, well, not every, because we don't have data on every, but there is data on associations in the literature between environmental exposures and all of those health effects and more. So the answer is just easier to say yes, all things.
Yeah, it's an accurate answer, but an unfortunate one, to say the least.
Yeah.
So, I mean, would it be fair to say, where it's like, okay, so we know from, say, animal trials and from, some human trials that there are certain health effects that have been, quite strongly linked. Like I seem to recall, like, having seen studies before, studying farmers who are exposed to, heavier amounts of pesticides than the average bear because they're the ones spraying the fields and maybe living in close proximity to, the pesticides or whatnot. Or of course the, animal trials, like, mice or what have you, where it's like, okay, we know that, these chemicals have this, physiology disrupting effect, shall we say. As you said, it's really hard to pin, like, health issues that people might have in their day-to-day lives on a given chemical, because it could be one or more chemical, it could be related to other things too. But given that we know that the chemicals can be taught, like, they're not good for our tissues, they might trigger or contribute to some of these conditions. My thought would be, well, maybe we should try to minimize our chemical exposure as much as we can to be on the safe side, because, maybe it won't trigger my ADHD or my asthma or whatever, but, like, maybe it will, or maybe it'll lower the threshold that me with me having one of those diagnoses. So, would it be fair to say that even though there are a lot of unknowns, to maybe erring on the side of caution and trying to keep the chemical exposure down would probably be a safer move than just rolling the dice.
Yes, absolutely. And we have many thoughts that I want to share, because every conversation is like also a choose your own adventure of how many different paths spring up. So one, I do want to say that we do have some preliminary data in human studies, in what are called intervention studies or avoidance studies, where researchers will take a group of people and say, hey, do this thing, do your normal thing. We're going to take a bunch of blood samples, urine samples, whatever. Then we want you to do this different thing, which is typically an avoidant behavior, meaning we want you to minimize exposure to these chemicals. We want you to not eat conventionally grown food. We want you to eat organic food. We don't want you to use these conventional personal care products. We want you to use ones that are free of these endocrine disruptors, and let's see what happens. And so we do have there's a sort of an emergent wave of these types of intervention studies that are happening, which are so needed because we don't have a lot of them, of like what happens when we do this activity. Because that validates our effort to minimize exposures. We need that validation to say, like, yeah, it is actually worth it to take the effort to work towards minimizing it. There was a study that was published just last year, at the end of last year. It was a small study looking at healthy women with no history of breast cancer, and researchers took a fine needle aspirate sample of breast tissue at the beginning of the study when participants were just using their regular personal care products. And then they had them switch to personal care products that were free of phthalates and parabens and I think two or three other compounds. And then they resampled their breast tissue and they were looking for markers for breast cancer. And what they saw was in these healthy women with no history of breast cancer or any other type of cancer beyond, I think, melanoma. Is that after 28 days of switching to these personal care products that were free of endocrine disruptors, they saw the markers for breast cancer drop to a normal level, which indicates that prior they were not at a normal level, despite the fact that these women had no history of breast cancer. So that's like a very validating study. Obviously, it needs to be replicated, and we need more research like that. But, the short answer is yes, absolutely. I think there's very good reason for all people to work towards minimizing exposures in as many places as possible. And then with the caveat that I always like to add in is that we want to approach that with a sense of balance, because we cannot avoid all exposures. And stress is toxic, and stressing out about these exposures that we know are probably not good, or we suspect that they're not good, but we don't necessarily know exactly how it's going to affect us. There's a lot of unknowns in there. And so some people will really get their anxiety amped up, and they very much live in this place of panic and fear. And some of that is perpetuated by the way that people often talk about environmental exposures online in a really sensational and kind of fear-mongering manner, like the Chicken Little, the sky's falling, we're all going to die. And I think that that hurts the movement to have people become aware and take action on these exposures, because they're so panicked and they feel like it's an all or nothing exchange. And so, yes, we do everything that we can, and that threshold is different for all people. Everybody gets to decide where they draw the line of I'm willing to do this, but I can't do that. And so, yes, short answer is we all do want to work towards minimizing exposure, even in the absence of, absolute incontrovertible evidence that these things are directly causing health effects. I would also say that there are many people in this conversation that say if we don't have that degree of evidence, then it's not real, which is also not true.
That is true.
Yeah.
Well, I guess, and I appreciate you framing it that way because, yeah, certainly, well, with both of the podcasts that this interview is going to be posted for, but particularly with relation to the Optimistic Future podcast, the idea is like, let's leave the conversation feeling empowered about, like, what can we do to make a
Yeah.
difference? We definitely don't want to leave folks with this sense of like, oh my gosh, like, the sky is falling and what's the point?
Yeah.
We will circle around to some simple steps that folks can take, to minimize their chemical exposure. One little thing I'll just interject with here, just putting my naturopathic doctor hat on for a moment. I know for me personally, like, I've been avoiding chemicals as much, toxic chemicals or, as much as possible for many, many years. And if I, happen to be, I'm taking my oldest son to the movies tonight. If we happen to be sitting beside someone who's doused in cologne, like I'm not gonna like I'm leaving the theater or anything. It's like it's fine. It's gonna be fine. When I get home, I'm gonna take some glutathione. I'm gonna take some other antioxidants. I'm gonna take some mitochondrial support, not because I really need to, just because for good measure. And I've got them in my fridge, so I'm gonna take them. There are some damage mitigation strategies that are out there as well. So, yeah, it's just at the end of the day. It's not anything to lose sleep about, I don't think. Just, I think if we can try to make minimize as much as we can, but it's got to be within reason. And everybody's
Yeah.
threshold for that's going to be a little bit different.
Yeah. And there's some, there are some people that because they have some type of chronic illness or they have a multiple chemical sensitivity, they don't have that luxury. They don't have the luxury of sitting in the movie theater seat next to somebody with cologne. They would have to get up and leave. And so there is very much a sort of a continuum of how the people's tolerance. I think, that also complicates what recommendations we give to people, because it's always asterisk small print, unless you're dealing with these things, in which case you really, really do want to work very hard to minimize those exposures. And then there are populations of people who maybe don't have those types of chronic illnesses, but I would give them the same message because it's so much more important for them to minimize exposures, and that would be anybody looking to conceive or who's pregnant or who has small children, because children are so vulnerable to the effects of toxic exposure that, like, that is an audience that I would say you really do want to put forth as much effort as you can to minimize exposures, so that you can, kind of better stack the odds in your favor for having not only a healthy pregnancy and a healthy child, but a child that grows up to be healthy.
On the child note, it's one of the questions I was going to get to if we had enough time, but just such a good segue.
Yeah.
I'll just ask you. I mean, folks listening might be like, okay, yeah, so impact children more, but like, why? Like, why would it impact children more? My understanding, and if you could chime in on this, if I'm either wrong on this or maybe missing another explanation, my understanding is it has to do with just the fact that, kind of their volume to surface area ratio is just really skewed, that they're just going to sponge things up more. And then also just kind of dovetailing what you said earlier about like the PPAR gamma, it's like, oh my gosh, they're so full of stem cells. Like, those stem cells could potentially go rogue a lot more easily.
Yeah.
So, would you mind speaking to, those two aspects of things, if you agree with them, or if you don't, please let me know. And then any other mechanisms beyond those?
Yeah, no. I do agree, and I think there are more layers to it than that. I think first and foremost is if we're looking at the from conception and the first, few, the first, even the first trimester of fetal development, like, we're building a human being. And if you are interfering with the building process, by throwing certain toxic chemicals or hormone disrupting chemicals, when like the majority of development is a hormonally triggered process. And then we're throwing in these endocrine disrupting chemicals during this incredibly delicate process. There are these specific windows of development, and like exposure during, week six might have different effects than exposure during week 12 of fetal development, because these windows open and close as body systems are developing, as brain systems are developing, as organ systems are developing. And so this is part of where there's a whole sort of field of research or subfield of research that's looking at the fetal origin of adult disease. And there's, or fetal basis of FEBAD, if a couple of different ways that people say it. But it's basically saying a lot of the disease that we see in adulthood, whether that's cardiovascular disease or diabetes, metabolic disease, may actually have its origin in what happens in utero. And so that to me is like point number one. It's like we're building a literal human being. We should not. It's like I think of the like a terrible too many cooks in the kitchen, and some of those cooks are like poisoning the stew, right? And that's kind of what we're that framework. So one, we have these exposures that are happening during these incredibly delicate and sensitive windows of time that can really interfere with development. Some things like phthalates, for example, in fetal in boys can also can alter their the genital formation, and lead to things like there's a marker for like masculinization or feminization in many mammal species, not just in humans. And it's the anogenital distance. It's essentially the distance from the anus to the genitals. And the shorter it is, the more feminine, and the longer it is, the more masculine. When farmers are like sexing chicks to be like, that's a boy chick, that's a girl chick, that's what they're looking at, that little distance. And so what we see are phthalates can actually interfere with that process and result in a shorter anogenital distance in boys, and things like undescended testicles, a smaller penis size, hypospadias, which is a birth defect on the penis. So like we see these things in animal studies, and then we can see them kind of mirrored in the human population for people that have higher levels of phthalates in their bodies. And so there's some physical structural things that are happening. So that's again that sort of first point. The second is certainly there are hundreds and hundreds of chemicals that are crossing into the placenta. 50, 60 years ago, we thought that it was this like little chamber of nothing gets through it. It's pristine. It's sterile. That's not the case at all. There's hundreds of chemicals that have been measured in cord blood. And so we have this potential interference in the developmental process. And then to your point earlier is that, babies pound for pound have more skin, more surface area, breathe more air, drink more water or food than adults do. And they're doing that with less developed organ systems and capacity for detoxification. So they're not small humans, right? They're not just small adults. They don't have that same capacity that we do. Their exposure is often higher. There have been a handful of studies doing what are called body burden tests, where they're doing like a full analysis of the chemicals that are in all the members in the household, parents, teenagers, babies, and it's the babies that have the highest amounts, even though they're not necessarily interacting with the world the way that adults do. But that's part of it, because what do babies do? They crawl around on the floor, they put everything in their mouths, right? And so they have this amplified exposure, and they don't necessarily have fully developed detoxification systems to handle this type of exposure. So it's more concerning for those populations. The environmental exposures that they get are, to me, are more concern the most concerning than anyone else.
Me too. I know, like I'm in my early 40s. I remember when I was a kid, and not that we were all chatting about each other's health or anything, but it's like pretty much everybody in the class was healthy, like maybe one or two kids with asthma, maybe like one child on the autism spectrum in the whole school kind of thing. Like, that was about it. And then nowadays, like you go into a classroom and like just every kid has some diagnosis of something, like, with some exception, like it's kind of just completely flipped. And, correlation doesn't equal causation, but there's just only so many, variables that, affect the whole planet. And, I think the chemicals and there, as you said, there's like certainly a lot of very compelling literature and, physiological explanations to, support that there's, yeah, toxins are probably not, probably could be very well a contributing factor, I think.
To a lot of those things. And certainly, I think the argument typically when you're talking about things like autism and ADHD is, oh, people are just getting better at diagnosing it. And to a degree, that is true. People are more aware of these diagnoses. And so they're quicker to say, ah, you should get assessed. You should get your kid assessed. Yep, they're on the spectrum. Okay, great. And so yes, there is that, but there is not, that is not the entirety of the picture. For certain. And so, typically when we see disease rates or diagnosis rates increasing at rates then that at rates that can be that how can I say this easily? Increasing at rates that cannot be explained by genetics alone, right? Genetics takes a long time for that. For that, say, oh, okay, we've got multiple generations and here's what we're seeing. But if a disease or diagnosis is increasing at a rate faster than that, there's something environmental going on. And environmental in this example can mean not just our toxic exposures, but your lifestyle and your stress and trauma and how well do you sleep and do you smoke? Like all of those sort of non-physiological factors. And so, like all things in health and public health, it's complicated.
Definitely complicated. I think this what we just chatted about is a pretty good segue into just to talking about how how are these chemicals approved? Because folks listening might be thinking like, well, wait a minute, like they must have done all these studies showing that it's safe on babies and safe to be exposed to, like 1,000 chemicals a day and all these things. Otherwise, why would there be like so many air fresheners on the market and so many artificially scented products? Why is there an entire perfume section in the department store? If they still have department stores, I'm not sure if they
Yes, they
exist
do.
anymore, but they used to anyways. But would you be please speak to how these chemicals are approved? How is it that there hasn't been rigorous study on all of this? Because it based on what you're saying, it sounds like there hasn't been rigorous study on all these chemicals, individually or in combination. So could you please speak to the approval process, or lack thereof for these chemicals, please?
Yeah, I mean, and that in and of itself is an enormous topic. So I'll do my best to do like the Reader's Digest version. First of all, I want to say that if you look kind of historically, at least in the United States, at how our policies that are intended to regulate chemicals happened, they all happened after the fact, meaning we didn't have. We don't know what we don't know. So, there's a degree of hubris and there's a degree of just ignorance, right? Because we don't know what we don't know. And so, we had certain incidents in the early 1900s, the mid 1900s, that really kind of turned people's attention to chemicals in some consumer products or in food. And regulation always happened on the heels of a giant tragedy. That's literally how, it has evolved over time. And so we never had really good proactive framework. It was always a reactive framework. In the 1976, when the United States passed its first sort of major piece of policy to regulate the majority, not all, but the majority of chemicals in commerce, which was the Toxic Substances Control Act or TSCA. At the time, there were like 62,000 chemicals already being used on the market, and they just got grandfathered in like rubber stamp, like, yeah, you're probably fine. You're probably fine. And so that happened. And then, over the decades since, we had many, many, many chemicals coming to market. But that original piece of policy in 1976 didn't have any kind of requirement that chemicals be tested for safety prior to going to market. In the United States, we have tort law, and we have specifically toxic torts. And this is a legal framework where basically, if somebody is harmed or believes that they're harmed by a toxic chemical, they can sue for damages. And so corporations who were really benefiting from these very lax regulations about you need to prove a chemical is safe beforehand, they didn't have any burden of to demonstrate safety, so they just could kind of do whatever they wanted, and the idea was that the market would correct if anything was wrong, meaning if our product harmed you in some way, sue us. That's what the legal system is for. And so corporations really relied on this framework, this paradigm of if you think you were harmed, please sue us. This we love the legal system. But how many individuals can afford to go up against a giant multinational company? Most can't. This is why cases like the Johnson and Johnson talcum powder and the glyphosate cases against Monsanto Bayer always make headlines, because they are the only manufacturer who manufactures that chemical. When it comes to something like BPA or phthalates that are used ubiquitously in the marketplace, who are you going to sue? Everyone? There's no framework for it. And so we have this really terrible system, and we don't require chemicals to be tested for safety prior to going to market. That's starting to change a little bit, but it's an incredibly slow process because we have this enormous backlog of chemicals on the market, around 42,000 chemicals actively being used right now. We have data on very few of them. And the data that we do have on many of these chemicals is not really representative of the reality of human exposure. So what I mean by that, and this goes back to what you were saying earlier about like animal research, is the majority of chemicals have been tested on, rodents and various cells, fruit flies, whatever, snails, different animal species. And typically the model is that incredibly high levels of fill-in-the-blank chemical are tested, right? Sometimes tens of thousands of times higher than people would actually be exposed to. And that is not a representation of our actual exposure. And that is that type of testing is really based on this sort of 16th century understanding of toxicology, which is that the dose makes the poison. I hear this all the time. I hear it continue to be parroted by medical professionals, by people that are otherwise very educated. And the dose makes the poison is basically this framework that says basically anything can be a poison or toxic. It's the dose that actually determines whether or not something is poisonous or toxic. And for many, many exposures, that is actually true. So radiation is a really good example of an exposure that is worse if you get more, and less, not a big deal. But what we're learning in the field of environmental health and these consumer product and environmental exposures is that many of these chemicals that we're exposed to, in particular, these endocrine disrupting chemicals, these hormone disrupting chemicals, they don't play by that framework. More is not worse, or it's differently worse, but less, and in fact, levels that are would never be studied in traditional toxicology, very, very low levels. Those are the levels that we're exposed to as people in the world. Those are also the levels that we're seeing in animal studies. And certainly we don't test chemicals on people, right? There's ethical reasons. Certainly have historical incidences where that's happened, but like as a rule, we don't test chemicals on people. And so we have to look at animal data. There's now more and more research in animal models looking at these really low exposures, the tiny amount of chemicals in your shampoo, in your shaving cream, in your body lotion, in your whatever, deodorant, in your lip gloss, and all the things, and saying, what effect does that have? Because that type of exposure level is not being examined by what's referred to as regulatory toxicology. Regulatory toxicology is the field of toxicology that informs how chemicals are regulated or not, as it were, right? And so that sort of It's like the if you don't look for it, you'll never find it model. If you're not looking for low dose effects, you're not going to find any. But you can't then also make a blanket statement about those exposures being safe if you've not tested them directly. And that's where, again, that dose makes the poison framework kind of falls apart when it comes to endocrine disrupting chemicals.
And thank you for sharing all of that. Just for folks who are like, oh my gosh, like she said tort law, and then I kind of got a
I know,
little
my brain
glazy.
just kind
No,
of.
no, yeah. And I mean, just for those folks, I'm sure a minority of the folks listening, but just in case, like, so a big take home messages there, that I would summarize it down. And please tell me if I'm missing anything here or misrepresenting anything here. But you know, there's a laundry list of at least 62,000 chemicals that have really not been studied. They kind of just got grandfathered in. There's a minimal amount of testing that's done on chemicals. It's usually after the fact, after they've already been brought into the market. And the tests or studies that have been done are oftentimes, it sounds like in a majority of cases, not representative of what we're actually being exposed to day to day. So kind of the question around like, oh, like, you know, it must be, if you know the government's involved, like it must be safe. It's like, well, no, this is an example of that not being the case. Did I miss anything with those bullet points?
No, I mean, I think an easier way to kind of, or an easy way to summarize it is that, the United States takes a innocent until proven guilty, right? Like that works really well for legal, for criminal cases, things like that. But for chemicals, why are we just assuming that everything is safe when we have like over 100 and, 130 years plus of evidence that this is, they're not always safe, right? And so if we contrast that with the regulatory framework that's applied in the European Union, although they're far from perfect, they follow what's referred to as the precautionary principle, which says basically like a better safe than sorry. Like, hey, if there's evidence that this chemical has health effects that we, at these exposures, we're going to either restrict it or we're going to ban it or we're going to limit its sale. And so they have a much more sort of rigorous framework and review process for chemicals. Again, that's not to say that they're perfect. They're not, but they at least have a framework that makes more sense than from a health standpoint is better safe than sorry.
And to my understanding, I believe, and I'm certainly not an expert in it, I believe there's a lot of overlap or similarity between how, because I'm up in Canada, many of our
Yes.
listeners are Canadian, so I understand that like Canadian and US sort of policies and procedures around this are quite different. We're much more US like than European like, shall we say, in that regard. Would you be able to give us an example or two of like a chemical that say is, you know, in widespread use over here and, you know, is on the no, you're not going to use this, or like it's very, very tightly regulated over in Europe?
Yeah, I mean, I don't normally get into like food ingredients, but certainly like artificial colors in the European Union are highly restricted. And there are a lot of artificial colors that are not allowed because there's enough evidence to suggest that they are related to behavioral issues, in specifically in children. And so the what's wild, and this is where people will often and rightfully so get very upset about this, is that they'll learn that Kraft macaroni and cheese in the United States uses, red number four, red 40 and yellow whatever, FD&C dyes. And in the European Union, they're using like annatto as a food coloring or turmeric, right? They're using natural materials or ingredients to add the same color. It's not exact, it's not that like neon orange, right? But it's still, no one cares. And so what we see are corporations that will reformulate, these multinational corporations that in order for them to do business in the European market, they have to abide by those stricter, whatever stricter standards that they have. And then when it comes to the US market, they will literally have a different production facility and a different production for that same product. And so oftentimes the argument from these companies is like, it's too expensive. We don't, it's like, but you've already done it. You literally are already doing it. You're doing it for them. Why can't you do it for us? And it's because they don't have to do it. So why would they go through any effort, any additional effort or expense? Because it cuts into their bottom line. So, food coloring is just this very small example of chemicals that have been more heavily restricted in the EU that are not at all restricted here. California actually just at the end of last year moved to statewide ban some food coloring ingredients and other food ingredients that's modeled more after the European Union. And when California, which is the largest state in the country and the largest economy in the country, I think that's correct, when they pass legislation like this, it does have a ripple effect into the rest of the country. And so those are always a really big win. Because in the same way, manufacturers who are selling to California, if you want to sell in the Cal if you want to sell in the biggest market in the US, you're going to have to abide by those laws. And they're not going to want to make a separate line of macaroni and cheese for California. So they're just going to, it becomes the de facto standard across the country. So good job, California.
Indeed. Yep. California for the win on that
Yeah.
one. As we've kind of alluded to a couple of times here, I think that leaving folks with some simple steps that they can take to minimize their chemical exposure in their lives would I think be a good next thing to chat about. It's as you've very articulately put, it's a big issue. There's a lot of unknowns. The likelihood of the regulatory framework changing anytime soon in our respective countries or in other places is probably pretty low, but as you also just touched on, ultimately the manufacturers are really at the beck and call of the consumers. So suddenly it's like we're not selling cologne anymore. Like what, what are we, how are we going to make our money? It's like, well, maybe we'll make some essential oil based compounds, or we're just not
Sure.
selling Febreze anymore. Maybe we'll, make something else. So we're changing things from the top down. By golly, that can be a long, arduous process.
Yes.
Glad there's some wins in that regard. Europe's maybe setting a better model, but in terms of kind of working from the ground up, would you be able to share some of the some simple choices that folks could make to help minimize their chemical exposure, please?
Yeah, absolutely. I really like to frame this part of the conversation through the lens of like starting with what's free and what's easy. So much of what is discussed about environmental toxicity or just health in general and wellness in general, especially online, is really positioned as something really that only affluent people can afford. And I take a lot of issue with that because toxicity not only is something that affects everybody, but the people who are most exposed are people that are low income, they're Black and Brown communities that are have disproportionate exposures and often disproportionately less access to healthcare. And so I really do take strong issue with, the solution being go buy this $10,000 sauna or go buy this, $5,000 medical device and that's how you be healthy. I think that that's not the framework to look at it. So in terms of where people can start with what's free, the number one thing that I re recommend people do that's free and will eventually save people money is to just stop buying and stop using scented candles, air fresheners, room sprays, car, Febreze sprays, anything that adds fragrance to your home environment. All of those products, and there's going to be different issues with different versions, like a scented candle is going to have a slightly different issue than, say, a Febreze. But those scented products are constituting a constant ongoing exposure to not only phthalates, which are that hormone disrupting chemical that I mentioned earlier, that was one of the key chemicals that were being looked at in that breast cancer study. Not only phthalates, but many other volatile organic compounds that are released from those fragrances. They are, can be hormone disrupting, they can be allergenic, they can be respiratory triggers, they can trigger headaches and migraines. There's just this laundry list of health effects associated with phthalates. And when we're using scented products in our home, we are literally polluting not only the air in your home, but the items in your home, because those phthalates will stick around. There was a meta-analysis of house dust studies from around the world, and in those studies, 100% of samples tested positive for phthalates, had various phthalates in them, because when we spray a perfume or a Febreze or a room spray, those chemicals don't just like evaporate, they actually settle on the ground. That's why babies have higher exposures, because they crawl on that ground. So one of the best things I think people can do, doesn't cost you a penny, is to just throw out, don't use them, scented candle, even if you're not burning it, if you can smell it, it's still releasing those compounds. So just stop buying those and don't buy them again. And that will save you money in the long term. So that's free item number one. Free item number two is open your windows. Right, we want increased air exchange in our homes, not just the phthalates and the volatile chemicals that off-gas from these fragrances, but a lot of the things that we bring into our homes or that our homes are constructed out of are releasing toxic chemicals constantly for the life of the time of the material, not just in the beginning. And so if we don't open our windows, we are not letting those chemical molecules escape. We now build homes that are more energy efficient, and we have, windows that don't open, and all kind, just for the sake of energy savings, and that's great, but it creates this lowered air exchange. So we want to open our windows as frequently as possible every day if you can do it. Indoor air is often more polluted than air outside, and there's regulations. Environmental regulations for outdoor air. They don't exist for indoor air. So we really want to clean our indoor air quality. Taking off your shoes is another really simple thing that you can do to stop kind of tracking things like pesticides and heavy metals from car exhaust and from walking through the park. It's not just about, tracking in dirt and dog poop. We do also track in a lot of chemicals. And so taking off your shoes is a really simple, free intervention. Beyond that, outside of free, the things that are easy are things like sw switching out your personal care products and your household cleaners. They don't have to be more expensive. This is a process that people can go through. It's not a just kind of take your arm and sweep it across the bathroom counter and throw everything in the garbage. You just use the products that you have until they're done. And when you go to replace them, that's when you can look for products that have better ingredients that are not made with any of these really questionable ingredients. I certainly have a list on my website of all different types of products that people can use if people want to look there. So addressing household cleaners and personal care products is a good place to start. Minimizing the use of plastics in the
I'm sorry,
kitchen.
Lara, could I interrupt for just one second? Sorry, just
Yeah, of
on that
course.
personal care product note, because just, devil's advocate, someone would be like, well, like it's more expensive to buy, the natural thing than Mr. Clean or something like that, and not by like dozens of dollars, but maybe for some folks, like a few dollars makes the difference. I'm just wondering if you could speak to using things like, baking soda or vinegar, which are like just pound for
Yes.
pound way cheaper than any of the cleaners out
Yes.
there. Are there solutions like that that folks could use at least around like as cleaners?
Yeah, absolutely. So baking soda is a really good abrasive. So it replaces any kind of scrubbing for your bathtub or even your toilet or your kitchen sink. Vinegar and vinegar water solutions can be used. Some people who have like asthma or respiratory issues, acetic acid can still be irritating. So they may have to change the ratio of vinegar to water to make it a little bit more tolerable. But also just like a plain unscented dish soap also goes a long way. I think, the trend, it's a long time trend of buying all of these different household cleaners and the this one's for the kitchen and that one's for the bathroom and this one's for the toilet and that one's for the tub. It's like they're just surface cleaners, and you don't need one, a different one for every surface. And so people are spending a lot of money on products that they don't really need, to be honest. And so if you can save money on not buying, seven or eight different cleaners, then you can afford to buy some better, more natural cleaners that might be a dollar or two more expensive than, what you get at the department store that, at Target or whatever. And so there's a little bit of like some wiggle room there because you just don't need all of those different products. It's just unnecessary. So yeah, certainly baking soda, vinegar, those can be great, sort of general cleaners. I don't think that we need, unless somebody in a household is like immunocompromised, I don't think we need all of these kills 99% of germs. It's just overkill. It's unnecessary. This is also true, during cold season and viral season. We don't need hand sanitizer. That's great if you're on the go. But soap and water is the most effective in those instances. And so I feel like we have this idea that we have to like bring out the sort of nuclear weapon when we're cleaning everything, and we really don't. We really don't.
Thank you. And sorry for interrupting your list. You're on.
Yeah, no.
Oh,
Yeah,
yeah.
it's all good. I think another place that is, a more accessible place to start minimizing exposures is to just look at the plastic materials, in the kitchen. Like, plastic is not going anywhere. My chair is made out of plastic. My computer mouse is made out of plastic. Like, we're surrounded by plastics. So those aren't going to go away. But when it comes to direct food contact, I think there's a lot that we can do to minimize exposure to plastics, and the chemicals that are used in plastics. So one, we don't heat our food in the microwave in plastic containers. That's a hard no. If the food comes in a plastic container, we put it on a plate, we put it on a bowl. But there's so many plastics that we have in our kitchen that we don't really think about. Our pasta strainer, our ladles, our kitchen spatulas. If there's kids in the house, they're probably eating off of plastic plates and drinking out of plastic cups that they're chewing on because they're teething or whatever, right? And so we want to start systematically minimizing the amount of plastics and eliminating them in as many places as we can. Food packaging is pretty hard because most pa food, still comes in plastic. And if people can afford to buy the versions that are packaged in glass, great. If you have those little plastic Tupperware containers, put crayons in them, put them in the garage so you can sort your nuts and bolts, but just don't put food in them. There's other ways that we can repurpose those materials without having to throw them out. But then, you can invest in some, and it's a very low investment, glass containers for food. And if people don't, I mean, my favorite are Ball Mason jars, which you can buy, in the States at for I think 15 of them for like, or 12 of them for like $15. So like just over a dollar a jar, and they'll last for years. And they're really great, low cost, multi-purpose material and item in the home.
As far as the and thank you for those recommendations and just and I don't know why I get hung up on like perfume and cologne. I think I don't know
Yeah,
because
that's
I hate the
funny.
smell of it and it's like
I
every time I
know.
smell I'm like you're like it's bad for you, it's bad for me, like just would you lump that in with like not buying scented products or would you give that its own special category or
Yeah, I mean, yes, and I say that because it's a little bit harder, I think, for people to kind of move away from those products, right? Once you do move away from using them and then you re-encounter them, sometimes you're like, how did I ever live this way? I've talked to so many people that they actually become more sensitive. I literally was at the Apple store at the Genius Bar last week. And the guy who was helping me asked me what I did, and I told him, and he goes, since I had COVID and my sense of smell changed, I cannot stand colognes and perfumes and scented candles. They give me immediate headache. And I'm like, okay, well, you know what to do. Don't use them anymore. Don't buy them. Yeah, I mean, I certainly think that people tend to overuse perfumes and colognes. Those products will also contain phthalates. They will also contain allergenic chemicals and endocrine disrupting chemicals. I know a lot of people, especially in the health space, really love essential oils. I'm not actually a huge essential oil fan. I think it's okay in in moderation and careful use. I think people tend to overuse essential oils, and they just kind of look at them through this lens of the nature fallacy, which is assuming that because it's natural, it's safe, and that's not the case. There are many things that are natural. Lead is natural, arsenic is natural, mercury, opium, natural. Like, these things are all very arsenic, highly toxic, and so we can't make the assumption that because it's quote natural, it's better. And so I really just do encourage people to move towards being fragrance free, not just in their home fragrances, but in their cleaning products. Cleaning products don't need to have a lemon scent or a pine scent or a floral scent. They just don't. That's often masking a chemical smell, or it's just covering up a bad smell in your house that you're not addressing. And so moving towards being as fragrance-free as possible in all types of products, I think is it certainly is the best move.
Awesome. Well, thank you for that, Laura. And I will post that list of simple steps to take on the Optimistic Future podcast website. So for easy reference, or check the transcript of the podcast episode. Laura, I know I've kept you for a while, a little bit longer than we were anticipating. So thank you for all of your time. I know you have so much information to share, and I just want to double check. I know we've covered lots of good topics and everything. Is there anything, like any last item that you wanted to mention? Like anything like, oh yeah, I got to make sure I mention that, or have we done a pretty good job covering
I think we kind of covered a lot of it. I think, the only thing that I would reiterate is, this information can be really overwhelming for people, can be scary. And just like you said earlier, the goal is really to educate and empower people to make more informed decisions and to be able to hopefully navigate this topic with less anxiety. I like to remind people that it's not, there's for the most part, under like 99% of circumstances, no single exposure is going to be the problem. It is really the accumulation of many small exposures over a lifetime that are really problematic. And so it allows us to have, just like you were sharing about, being in the movie theater and having somebody wearing cologne or perfume next to you, it gives us a little bit of an allowance and a little bit of kind of grace or leeway with some of those exposures that we can't avoid. So no single exposure to a fragrance, chemical is going to result in weight gain. That's not how it works. It is the accumulation and sort of chronic nature of these exposures over long periods of time that are problematic. And so, we change, my motto is we change the things that we can control, so we worry less about the ones that we can't. And there's plenty that we can't control and do very much about. And rather than panic, we just say, where can I focus my efforts in doing better of the things that I can change? And so I would just kind of leave people with little exposures that you get here and there likely are not going to be a big deal for you. What we're aiming for is a systematic reduction in as many places as possible over the long term.
Awesome. That's very well said. Thank you, Lara. Just before we wrap up here, would you mind just sharing with folks where they can find you on Instagram, what your website is? I know when we were chatting before the actual interview started, and you kind of maybe alluded to it, you offer training for clinicians. So could you just kind of let us know how folks can have more of you if they want after this
Yes,
podcast is over?
absolutely. So people, if you're a health professional or any type of individual with a health-based business and you want to learn more about this, certainly there's lots of information and courses on my website, which is just my name, lauraadler.com. And for everybody, health professional or not, I have my Instagram, which is Environmental Toxins Nerd, and there is tons and tons of really good and accessible education there for free that anybody can take. And feel free to say hi. I'm very active on that platform. So those are the two places where I spend all my time.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much again for your time, Lara. It was a really great chat. And yeah, I really appreciate everything that you're doing and all the information you're sharing. It's super, super important. So thank you for that.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And thank you to everyone for listening to this episode of the Overcoming Chronic Illness podcast and the Optimistic Future podcast, maybe listening to one or both. But thank you for your attention, and please stay tuned for the next episode.